A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Here's the scene Daniel lays out for us. He's standing in his apartment in Jerusalem, boxes stacked everywhere, and a crew of Arab movers is loading his family's belongings onto a truck. He's an Israeli Jew. He's spent years learning Palestinian Arabic because he genuinely believes coexistence is possible. And yet, in that moment, he's got a voice in his head asking, "Are these guys packing my stuff while part of them wants to blow me up?" And he's immediately ashamed of that voice. But it's there.
That's the thing that hits you right in the chest. He's not describing a political rally or a checkpoint. He's describing the most mundane Tuesday imaginable. A moving truck. Furniture wrapped in blankets. And yet every single second of that interaction is saturated with history neither side can name out loud.
Daniel's honest enough to say it. He knows surveys from East Jerusalem. Palestinians show disturbing levels of support for October 7th. He also knows they've probably experienced prejudice and maybe racial hatred from Israeli Jews their whole lives. He might represent a trauma to them. So he's caught in this loop where every possible way of being feels wrong. Speak Arabic and you're tokenizing them. Stay silent and you're denying who they are. Be friendly and you're performing. Be distant and you're confirming every suspicion they might have about Jewish arrogance.
What gets me is the asymmetry he's pointing at without quite naming it. Daniel has the luxury of standing there worrying about whether he's coming across as a good person. The moving crew doesn't have that luxury. They're working. They need the job. They're probably far more focused on not dropping a bookshelf than on decoding Daniel's existential crisis about coexistence.
The unspoken part isn't a failure of the interaction. It might be the only thing making the interaction possible.
That's where this gets interesting. Because what Daniel's describing isn't some rare, charged encounter. It's the texture of daily life for hundreds of thousands of people in this city. You buy bread from a baker who voted for a party you find abhorrent. You share an elevator with a neighbor whose cousin was arrested at a protest last week. You hand your toddler to a pediatrician whose political beliefs you will never know and probably don't want to.
The micro-coexistence economy.
And I don't mean that cynically. I mean these are the unscripted, unmediated interactions that happen completely outside the frame of organized peace programs or dialogue groups. Nobody's facilitating. Nobody's provided a curriculum. There's no icebreaker exercise where you share your personal narrative with a partner.
Just two people trying to get a couch through a doorway without scraping the paint.
And that's why this moving day matters beyond Daniel's personal anxiety about it. It's a case study in what scholars sometimes call the contact hypothesis, this idea that if you just get groups interacting, prejudice goes down. But the reality is much messier. Daniel's standing there with all this interior noise, and the movers are almost certainly not standing there wondering whether he's a good person. They're wondering if he's going to pay on time, if the job will run late, if the truck fits in the alley.
The asymmetry of who gets to have an existential crisis on a Tuesday.
That's not a moral failing on Daniel's part. He's aware of it. That's the whole point of his prompt. But naming the asymmetry matters because it reframes the entire interaction. The silence he's so uncomfortable with, the things going unspoken, that's not a bug. It's the feature that lets the transaction complete.
The silence is doing work.
It's doing enormous work. It's holding the space where two people with fundamentally incompatible narratives about the same piece of land can still hand each other a box of dishes without incident. And I think that's the thesis we need to sit with here. The unspoken isn't emptiness. It's full. It's functional.
The question isn't how to fill the silence with the right words. The question is what that silence is actually made of and whether it's sustainable.
Whether, for the person on the other side of it, the silence feels like protection or like erasure. That's where we need to go next.
Before we unpack that, I want to sit with this idea of the silence being functional for just another minute, because I think there's a temptation to romanticize it, to say, oh, the silence is beautiful. It's holding everything together. But functional doesn't mean good. A dam is functional. It holds back a flood. That doesn't mean the water behind it isn't dangerous.
That's a useful distinction. Functional doesn't mean healthy. It means it's doing a job. And the job here is preventing the interaction from collapsing into something unmanageable. But the pressure behind the dam doesn't go away just because the dam is holding.
The silence is a temporary structure. And the question underneath Daniel's anxiety might actually be, how long can this hold?
What happens if it doesn't? Let's pull apart what's actually happening in Daniel's head, because I think he gave us the raw material for three distinct anxieties. The first is the fear of being seen as a symbol of oppression. Not a person, not a neighbor, not a guy who needs his couch moved, but a representative of the state that controls their lives.
He's worried he is the checkpoint, in human form.
And that's not entirely neurotic. If you're an East Jerusalem Palestinian, your daily experience of Israeli Jews is disproportionately through institutions that have power over you, the police, the municipality, the border authority. Daniel knows this. So he's standing there thinking, I'm the face of the system whether I like it or not.
The second anxiety.
The fear of what's behind their eyes. The poll numbers he mentioned. The PCPSR survey from September 2024 found that 57% of Palestinians in the West Bank and 42% in Gaza supported the October 7th attack. Daniel's read those numbers. He can't unread them.
Here's the thing that actually complicates that. East Jerusalem wasn't broken out separately in that poll.
And that's crucial. East Jerusalem Palestinians have a fundamentally different legal and economic reality. They're permanent residents of Israel, not citizens, but they can work freely in the Israeli economy. They have access to Israeli healthcare. They interact with Israeli Jews every single day. The Jerusalem Institute for Policy Research did a study in 2023 that found 68% of East Jerusalem Palestinians prefer to work in the Israeli economy, and 41% would choose Israeli citizenship over Palestinian citizenship if that option were on the table.
You've got one set of numbers, saying widespread support for political violence in the abstract, and another set saying deep economic integration in the concrete. Those don't cancel each other out.
That's the insight. People are capable of holding views that look contradictory from the outside. Supporting armed resistance as a concept while also wanting your kids to go to Hebrew University and get a good job and live a normal life. The moving crew could easily contain both impulses in the same person. Daniel's fear isn't irrational, but it's also not the whole picture.
I'm thinking about how this maps onto other contexts. Think about a black American who's read the statistics on police violence, who knows the history, and then gets into a lift with a white driver who's a retired cop. That person might be holding both the abstract knowledge of systemic harm and the immediate need to get to the airport safely. The driver might be a perfectly decent human being. The statistics don't tell you anything about this specific human in this specific car.
That's the impossible thing Daniel is trying to do in real time. He's trying to reconcile the aggregate data with the individual human standing in his living room holding a box of his wife's shoes. The brain isn't built for that. It wants to collapse the tension. Either they're a threat or they're not. Either the poll numbers mean something or they don't. But reality refuses to collapse.
Then there's the third anxiety, which is the one that actually seems to torment him the most. The fear of doing allyship wrong. Should he speak Arabic? Should he not? Is he connecting or tokenizing?
That's where the silence comes in. There's a framework from social psychology that helps here. Gordon Allport, 1954, the contact hypothesis. He said intergroup contact reduces prejudice only under four conditions. Equal status between the groups, common goals, intergroup cooperation, and institutional support. Daniel's moving day has exactly one of those.
The common goal. Get the furniture in the truck.
That's it. They don't have equal status. Daniel is the employer. He's paying them. There's no institutional support. There's no facilitator saying, okay, everyone, let's share how we're feeling about this credenza. So what does contact theory actually predict here? Not prejudice reduction. It predicts that both parties will default to whatever strategy protects them.
For the movers, the protective strategy is probably being efficient, polite, and invisible.
It's not avoidance. It's a rational calculation. If you're a Palestinian worker in an Israeli Jewish home, the safest thing you can be is unremarkable. Your livelihood depends on being perceived as non-threatening. Daniel's wrestling with whether to speak Arabic, and from his perspective, that's a gesture of respect. but from their perspective, it might feel like a demand to stop being invisible.
The silence isn't empty. It's full of information about the power structure.
It's doing work for both sides. For Daniel, it's holding his anxiety in check. For the movers, it's maintaining the professional frame that lets them get paid and go home without incident. The discomfort Daniel feels isn't a sign that something's gone wrong. It's a sign that he's accurately perceiving the structural asymmetry of the situation.
Which means trying to fix the discomfort by saying the right thing might actually be missing the point entirely. We've only been looking at one side of this interaction. Let's flip the lens. What might the moving crew actually be experiencing?
There's a scholar at Hebrew University, Dr. Yael Berda, who's done ethnographic work on how Palestinian day laborers navigate what she calls invisible surveillance. The constant awareness that your livelihood, your ability to feed your family, depends entirely on being perceived as non-threatening by the Jewish Israelis who hire you.
They're not just moving furniture, they're managing an impression.
The way they stand, the tone of voice, how quickly they respond to an instruction. All of it is being read, and they know it. Daniel's worried about what they think of him. They're worried about whether he thinks they're dangerous.
Jazz.
It's a full cognitive load on top of the physical labor. And here's where it gets tricky for Daniel's dilemma about speaking Arabic. The movers are likely performing what I call a kind of performative normalcy. They're being efficient, polite, professionally neutral. Not because they have no political views, but because the power structure demands that performance.
If Daniel suddenly whips out his Palestinian Arabic, he might actually be disrupting that performance, forcing them to acknowledge the very ethnic dimension they're trying to keep neutral, so the job can just get done.
From this perspective, the safest version of this interaction is employer and workers, not Jew and Arabs. Daniel's Arabic, however well-intentioned, says, "I see your identity," which sounds nice in the abstract, but in that room it might feel like, "I am now making your identity the subject of this interaction, whether you want it to be or not."
He's caught. Speak Arabic and you might be tokenizing them. Stay silent and you might be denying who they are. There's no winning move.
I think that's the point. The fact that there's no winning move isn't a failure of Daniel's imagination. It's a feature of the structure. This is what scholars mean when they talk about the Jerusalem paradox. The city is physically integrated. Jews and Arabs live in the same neighborhoods, use the same streets, shop at the same markets, but it's socially segregated. You pass each other, you transact, you don't mingle.
The moving truck, though, that's different. That's not passing on the street. That's genuine interdependence. Daniel needs their labor. They need his payment. For a few hours, their fates are actually linked.
That's why this moment matters more than the coffee shop or the grocery line. Economic interdependence is the most honest ground for interaction in this city. It doesn't pretend to be friendship. It doesn't require shared narrative. It just requires that the couch gets up 3 flights of stairs without anyone getting hurt.
Which makes it more revealing than the structured coexistence programs. And I don't want to dismiss those. The hand-in-hand school, the Max Rain School here in Jerusalem, 600 kids, half Jewish, half Arab, learning in both Hebrew and Arabic. Studies show graduates have significantly lower prejudice scores. That's real.
And the Jerusalem Foundation runs over 40 shared living initiatives now. Joint sports leagues, community gardens, professional networking groups. But those are facilitated spaces. There's a curriculum, a trained mediator, institutional support. The moving truck has none of that. No bilingual policy. Just 2 groups trying to get through a Tuesday.
That's the default state. The moving truck is what coexistence looks like when nobody's watching, nobody's funding it, nobody's taking notes for a peace studies journal.
Which is why Daniel's discomfort isn't a problem to solve. It's information. The silence in that room isn't empty. It's full of the power differential, the history, the mutual suspicion, and also the mutual need. All of it compressed into the space between handing someone a box and saying nothing.
If Daniel's listening and wondering what he should have done differently, maybe the answer is that his discomfort was the most honest thing in the room. Where does that leave someone actually standing in the room? Because Daniel didn't write in for a sociology lecture. He wrote in because he's in the moment and doesn't know what to do with his hands.
And I think the first thing is to stop treating the discomfort like a problem that needs solving. The tension is legitimate. It's shared. The movers feel it too, just from the other side of the power equation. acknowledging that internally, just sitting with it instead of scrambling to perform your way out of it, that's already more honest than most people manage.
The performance is the trap. The moment you start thinking, I need to demonstrate that I'm one of the good ones, you've made the interaction about you.
So here's something concrete. Focus on the task, not the identity. These men are there to do a job. Treating them with professional respect, clear instructions, fair payment, a bottle of cold water if it's a Jerusalem July, that's more meaningful than any Arabic phrase you could deploy. It says, I see you as workers doing skilled labor, not as symbols of a political conflict.
Water on a hot day is a universal language.
It really is, and it doesn't require anyone to perform their ethnicity. Now, if you feel the need to acknowledge what's in the room, there's a way to do it that isn't about you. Something simple like, I know things are complicated right now, and I appreciate you being here. That's it. No speech about coexistence, no fishing for common ground. Just an honest acknowledgement that doesn't demand a response.
The difference is humility versus performance. One says, I see the tension, and I'm not pretending it isn't there. The other says, please validate that I'm a good person.
If they just nod and keep working, that's fine. You're not owed a moment of connection. The gesture lands, or it doesn't, and either outcome is okay.
Let me push on something here. You said the water, the clear instructions, the fair payment. That's enough. But isn't there a version of that that just becomes a slightly more polite version of ignoring the elephant in the room? Like, here's your water, here's your cash. Now please exit my home and my consciousness.
I think the difference is whether you're using the professional frame to avoid the human reality or to respect it. If you're thinking, I'll just treat them like furniture movers and pretend the political context doesn't exist, that's avoidance. But if you're thinking, the most respectful thing I can do right now is let them do their job without making them carry my emotional baggage about the occupation on top of my actual baggage, that's different.
The intention behind the professional frame matters.
And I think people can feel the difference. If you're using professionalism as a wall, they'll sense it. If you're using it as a container that holds the complexity without forcing anyone to drown in it, that lands differently. You might not get a smile or a thank you, but you also might not get the subtle stiffening of shoulders that happens when someone feels they're being managed rather than respected.
Which brings us to the broader point. These micro-interactions, the moving truck, the taxi ride, the contractor who fixes your sink, these are the actual raw material of coexistence. Not the peace conferences, not the op-eds, the thousands of mundane transactions that happen every day in this city without violence.
They don't need to be perfect. They don't need to end in a handshake or a shared meal. They just need to happen. A couch gets moved. Money changes hands. Everyone goes home.
The fact that Daniel is anxious about getting it right, that he's even asking the question, that's not neurosis. That's a sign that he's taking the other person's humanity seriously enough to worry about it. That's the opposite of indifference.
Indifference would be the real failure. He's uncomfortable because he cares. And that discomfort, that internal friction, is probably the most honest thing anyone brought into that room.
The truck pulls away. The furniture's in the new apartment. The crew's been paid. And Daniel's standing there alone with his boxes and his thoughts, still turning the whole thing over in his head. Did I say the right thing? Did I say enough? Did I say too much?
I think that's the image to sit with. Not the interaction itself, but the moment after. When the silence is no longer strategic, it's just silence. And the question that lingers isn't, did I get it right? It's, what was actually happening in that room?
What if the silence wasn't a failure of connection at all? What if it was the only form of connection possible under the circumstances?
That's the reframe that changes everything. We tend to think of connection as words, as recognition, as some moment of mutual understanding. But in a context where words are so loaded, where every acknowledgement of identity risks becoming a demand, silence can be a form of respect. It can say, I'm not going to make you perform your pain for me. I'm not going to force a moment of recognition you didn't ask for. We're just going to get through this together, and then you can go home.
The silence wasn't empty. It was full of restraint, full of the choice not to make things worse.
I think there's something here for anyone listening, not just in Jerusalem. These micro-interactions happen everywhere. The taxi driver whose politics you'll never know. The cashier who might have just come from a protest you'd find abhorrent. The colleague whose family situation you can't begin to guess at. We're constantly in rooms with people where enormous things are going unsaid.
The instinct is always to fill the silence, to find the right words, to bridge the gap. But maybe the skill isn't bridging. Maybe the skill is sitting with the discomfort and not rushing to resolve it.
Not every silence needs to be broken. Some silences are doing exactly what they need to do. They're holding the space where two people with incompatible realities can still hand each other a box and not drop it.
The next time you're in one of those moments, the moving truck of your own life, notice the silence. Don't try to fix it. Just notice what it's holding. The mutual need. And maybe the fact that you're even aware of it, that you're uncomfortable, that you care enough to worry about getting it wrong, that's not a problem.
It's the thing that makes the silence bearable.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In the 1970s, marine biologists off the coast of Greenland discovered a species of deep-sea sponge that provides structural shelter for a specific type of tiny crustacean, which in return cleans the sponge's filtration channels. The two species are found nowhere else on Earth and cannot survive apart.
A sponge and a shrimp bound together at the bottom of the Greenland Sea, utterly dependent and completely silent. That feels almost pointed. This has been My Weird Prompts. Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flumingtop, for making this show possible.
If you enjoyed this episode, tell a friend who's ever stood in a room full of unspoken things and didn't know what to do with their hands. We're at myweirdprompts.com.
Until next time.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.